From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we learn about the first LGBT uprising in Wisconsin, 8 years before the Stonewall riot in Greenwich Village kicked off the national gay pride movement.
The fact that there was a sizable LGBT community large enough to have their own spaces and large enough to fight back when those spaces were endangered shocked Milwaukee like nothing else.
Then we'll talk with the artist responsible for turning the Chase Building atrium into a jungle of flowers.
What you're seeing, what the public sees, what they're looking at is an actual painting. What you're seeing are not computer-generated or stock images that I've put together. What you're seeing is actually one of my paintings that I produced in the studio.
We'll have some thoughts on D-Day's 75th anniversary, and we'll visit a festival marking the end of Ramadan. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. June is Pride Month in the United States, and around the country, LGBTQ plus people are celebrating the progress the communities have made in gaining equal rights, even though there is still work to be done. Well, part of the celebration is remembering the activists before them that made getting here possible. 50 years ago, the Stonewall riots in New York's Greenwich Village kicked off the modern Pride movement. But 8 years before that, the patrons of an unassuming gay bar in a Milwaukee neighborhood that no longer exists took a stand against intolerance and disrespect. Historian Michael Takash joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski from Los Angeles to tell us about the Black Night Brawl.
After World War II, Milwaukee was fortunate enough to have spaces where LGBTQ people could gather and really start forming not what I'd call a community, but maybe the beginnings or the roots of a community. And one of these spaces was the 400 block of North Plankinton Avenue, which is now, as you know, a freeway off-ramp. So at that time, from 1949 until 1961, LGBT bars began opening in this block, mainly because the buildings were somewhat abandoned. The area was obviously marked for freeway construction, and there was really not a lot of interest in maintaining these buildings if they were just going to be torn down. So obviously, they were a perfect place for people who didn't want to be found except by those that they wanted to invite. And by August of 1961, there were actually four LGBT bars operating on this block, starting with the Riviera, which is the oldest, which had opened in fall of 1949, the Fox Bar, which opened in December of 1949, the Crystal Palace, which was just across the river in the 400 block of North Water Street, and then, of course, the Black Night, which was at 400 North Plankinton Avenue. And the Black Night actually had a long history before it was known as the Black Night. It was originally known as the Old Mill Inn, and was known as a sailor bar, which was essentially a men-only bar that was available for river and harbor workers to kind of gather in a bit of a rough place after hours. The other thing about the sailor bars was that they were often frequented by people who were looking for other sailors, which is kind of humorous when you think about it, that this man-only space could exist and that it was welcoming to people who really had nowhere else to go. At the time, these were really kind of outlaw places. It was illegal to serve homosexuals liquor in Wisconsin. It was illegal to allow them to congregate on your premises, and it could cost bar owners their licenses and bartenders their reputation. People could be fired for serving gay people in bars at the time. So in 1959, the Old Mill Inn closed, and a gentleman who was a bit of a financier and a bit of a whiz kid with money in Milwaukee saw an opportunity to open the city's first gay bar, which was really, a gay bar that was known. It was above the line. It was not secret. It was not underground. It was really advertising and publicizing. Another business owner had attempted this earlier, about a year earlier, and had failed. But they were really willing to make a chance with what became known as Mary's Tavern. And Mary's Tavern was only open for a short time. Mary, who was brought in from Oklahoma to manage and own the bar because the financier could not get a liquor license for various reasons, Mary came in and was a bit offended by what she saw and what she was promised. And essentially said that the homosexuals had run off all of her good customers, they were terrorizing her, and she could have danced in the streets when she found out the bar would be closing. So in 1961, this address, 400 North Plankinton, which had a long history by that time, opened up again as the Black Knight. And it's a curious story because a Kohl's food store butcher retired from his job and took over this business. And, I mean, he was a family man. He had children. He had been married several times. And it was a curious choice for him because he was opening a bar that was not only, once again, tolerating gay people, but inviting, welcoming, and celebrating them. So the Black Knight throughout 1961 became a bit of a famous place because it wasn't a straight bar that allowed people of LGBT origin into the building. It was a LGBT bar that might allow straight people into the building. And this was something new for Milwaukee. But what was most interesting about this story is what happened on August 4th, 1961. On that night, there were four servicemen from Great Lakes Naval Academy who had been partying at a Brady Street bar and were really kind of wound up. And the bartender at that bar gave them a dare and said, you know, I bet you a certain number of dollars that you won't go down to this bar on Plankinton Avenue. And the guys were like, well, why wouldn't we go down there? And he's like, you'll find out when you get there. So the guys came down to the Black Knight and upon arrival found out that it was a gay bar and were not exactly thrilled. They felt that they'd been kind of had by the dare. And when the bouncer asked them for ID, they refused to give it. When he asked them to sign a letter saying that they knew they were in a gay bar, they refused to sign it. This was a common practice at the time, so people couldn't say that they had been, you know, conned or robbed or scammed by the bar owner. So the bartender tried to kick them out, and once they got out on the patio on the sidewalk on the corner of St. Paul and Plankinton, all four men started jumping the bouncer. And this was early in the night, so their bar wasn't busy. It was essentially the bartender, the bouncer, and the bouncer's girlfriend, who was Josie Carter.
Josie is another key character in addition to the bar owner, Wally Weatham. So tell us a little bit about Josie before we get into the events that transpired after the servicemen were attacking the bouncer.
Sure. So I have to say, I mean, Josie was one of the most remarkable people I've met in the entire time I've been researching LGBT history in Wisconsin. Josie lived her life really socially as a gender nonconforming person of color at a time when this was unthinkable in Milwaukee. I mean, police officers could stop you if they suspected you were cross-dressing. They could inspect your genitals. They could force you to change your clothes. They could remove your clothes. They could do all sorts of horrible things. And somehow Josie persevered over all of this. She had great relationships with police officers. She commented on it frequently that she didn't have any trouble with the police unless she started trouble. She really was what we might call today a bit of a scenester. I mean, she and her friend Jamie Gaze, also a drag queen of the time, really set the scene in Milwaukee. I mean, someone who I interviewed recently said, you know, they weren't just part of a scene. They were the scene. Where they went, they made things happen. They made bars popular. They made people come. And they really paved the way for people to come out and go places and have fun. And that was really Josie's life. I mean, she was a person of leisure, and she was a hostess with the mostest. And it's just really amazing that, you know, when we met with her in 2011, she had really, you know, not a whole lot to say about this incident, which was pretty significant from a historical perspective. The story lead she gave us upon further research was of much greater magnitude than I think she ever even understood or expected. So on that night, on August 4th, 1961, it was one of those humid, foggy, gray August nights. Those servicemen left the bar in a huff, and they obviously were disgruntled. They were asked to leave the bar by the bouncer. They jumped the bouncer and started beating on him, and these are four Naval Academy recruits versus one single man who's unarmed. And the minute this happened, Josie said, you know, she stood up and she wasn't quite ready. Apparently, she was not fully dressed for the evening. She'd been kind of hanging out and sipping a cocktail and relaxing. But she grabbed two beer bottles and she went outside. And her exact words were, oh no, you're not going to beat up my man. And so she headed outside and, as she said, gave them everything she had in those bottles, and she took two of the guys out. So the remaining servicemen were amazed. I mean, they were stunned. They had literally been KO'd by a woman who, you know, they at that time did not even know was a drag queen, per se. So they left the premises. They went back to Brady Street. They went back to the bar. They said, pay up. We went to the bar. We got beat up. This is ridiculous. And as the guys continued drinking and the bartender was stoking the fires of their fury, they decided that they were going to round up some guys and go down and clean up the Black Knight for putting their friends in the hospital. And this was probably the dumbest decision these four guys have ever made in their life. And I would love to meet with them and hear their take on the story, if I could locate them. But whereas they encountered a bar that had just opened, it was barely busy, there were only three people in it when they first arrived. When they came back, there were 70-some people in the bar. The bar was at full capacity. And all of those people in the bar had been listening to Josie talk about these ruffians who came in, beat up her husband, and caused trouble. So when they opened the door, they thought that they were in for an easy fight. But they opened the door and said something along the lines of, come on, you sick f***. And every single person in the bar looked at them, and that was it. It was down. The music stopped, and the battle was on. And what's really interesting about this is that, you know, this isn't just a matter of people fighting back against violence. It was a matter of people fighting back against their turf being invaded, disrespected, and vandalized. This was their space, and they had fought long and hard to get it. There were other bars in town that had gone back, you know, a long time, but none of them were really lasting. None of them were really owned by the LGBT community. They were always owned by straight people who were trying to make money off the LGBT community, or straight bar owners who would, you know, collect money from the LGBT community but never actually admit it. So this was a bit of a turn in Milwaukee. This was a bit of a change in tone. And as the battle went on and the bar was literally leveled, I mean, everything inside was destroyed. Every bar stool, every bottle of liquor, the jukebox, the player piano, all windows. People were actually thrown through the windows. And in the end, the police came down and took everyone off in a paddy wagon. But none of the patrons of the Black Knight were charged or arrested for any reason. In fact, the police came down and told Josie, these people have no business harassing you, and we will take care of this for you.
Which and that seems like a pretty standout relationship and, you know, a unique police and community relations in a time where there's legal action you can take for serving homosexuals in a bar, for, you know, open cross-dressing on the street, for a police community to have a good relationship with Josie and the people of that bar. It seems like a really pinnacle moment and, you know, solidification of their place.
Absolutely. And I marveled at this story and thought this can't possibly be the way it went down, but it is exactly the way it went down. And finding, you know, newspaper documentation, finding firsthand reports of people who were there and just piecing together this greater story, it was really remarkable to stumble upon what is not only the first LGBT uprising in Wisconsin history, but one that occurred 8 years before the Stonewall Uprising, at a time where around the country these little uprisings were happening, but they received next to no media attention and next to no historical significance because no one was piecing together what was happening. These things happen in isolation and pockets, and unlike the Stonewall riots, there were not significant communities of writers who were LGBT-minded or even radical or revolutionary-minded in Milwaukee at the time. So the fact that this made the media and what happened next is even more significant. But the fact that, you know, the police were on the side of the LGBT community at a time where there was not much of a community is, like you said, unprecedented.
Right. And was there legal action taken against the servicemen who started the fight? You mentioned they were taken away, but was there any further legal repercussions for them?
There were and there weren't. So the servicemen were charged with a number of things. And the charges were listed in the paper. Their names and addresses were listed in the paper. I mean, they were really seen as problems. They were really the villains of the story, and rightly so. Unfortunately, Judge Christ T. Serafim reversed the charges, saying there was not enough evidence that they had actually started the fight, which at the time was laughable and really remains laughable today.
Right. To come back to the scene of your first fight, that's pretty clear indication.
Yeah, exactly. And so in the end, they really got off with not much more than a lot of bumps and bruises. The Black Knight fared worse. Wally was under a lot of stress to change the bar's name, to shut the bar down, to change the patronage to straight. Refused to do pretty much all of that until the Common Council made him. And he did change the name to Bourbon Beat, which it operated under until 1966. At that time, the neighborhood was really in peril because 794 was heading towards it, and St. Paul Avenue was actually extended over the river. At the time of the Black Knight Brawl, this was a dead end. So the bar was literally sitting at a dead end at the river where St. Paul now extends. So it was kind of in the way, and eventually it was torn down. But I think that, you know, the legacy of the Black Knight Brawl, there's so many layers to this. One, again, this is a historic uprising. This is something that wouldn't have happened had there not been a dedicated space that people felt that they owned and needed to defend. Number two, the fact that there was a sizable LGBT community large enough to have their own spaces and large enough to fight back when those spaces were endangered shocked Milwaukee like nothing else. I mean, people who were around at the time said it was the first time they had ever heard of gay people in Milwaukee. It was the first time they'd ever heard of violent gay people. The idea was that, you know, LGBT people were sick. I mean, they were psychologically unwell and that, you know, they needed to be fixed through behavior modification and conversion therapy. And the idea that gay people could rise up together and fight back against bullies was shocking to people in Milwaukee in 1961. And it sparked a couple of chain reactions. One, in early 1960s, there was a bit of a gay panic in Milwaukee. The media really fed this fire, saying that, you know, there were uncountable numbers of homosexuals lurking in Milwaukee, and they were under the surface, and at any moment they would strike, and they were, you know, predatory, and they were law-breaking, and there was just so much negativity around this. But what that did, by talking about the existence of gay people and the places where gay people were known to go, was that really the media was creating a blueprint and a roadmap for closeted gay people who thought they were the only ones in the whole world. People like Eldon Murray, who were founders of later LGBT organizations, commented that until the Black Knight Brawl and this media panic that followed, they literally thought there were no other gay people in the world, much less Milwaukee. And when these articles started coming out talking about homosexuality and talking about gay places and the fact that there was this gay underworld, it fascinated them to know that there was someone like them in the world, that they were reflected in this space. So really, really powerful in driving a sense of community in Milwaukee that really, you know, built up over time and continues to flourish today. It really could be said that the Black Knight Brawl, in many ways, is the birthplace of LGBT pride in Milwaukee, because before that, I mean, people were laying down and taking the abuse, and the Black Knight Brawl was the first time people fought back and said, no, I'm done with this. You will respect me and my places and my community. The other thing that happened was that gay panic led to some urban renewal choices, shall we say. Again, the freeway was routed directly through this neighborhood. It was routed through another neighborhood on the north side where the Park East Freeway once stood, where there were a number of LGBT landmarks after World War II. Really, the entire neighborhood as it stood, as it was known, as it was exposed by the brawl and the subsequent media panic, was erased by 1966. That whole area was gone. And I mean, much like other marginalized groups suffered under freeway construction, the LGBT community was really scattered to the wind. And it wasn't until 1968 when businesses started to congregate around First and Pittsburgh and Walker's Point, establishing Walker's Point really as the next big LGBT neighborhood, and that legacy continues today. But if it wasn't for this brawl, the media exposure that there was an LGBT community, the urban renewal choices that were made, and of course the congregation of businesses in Walker's Point, we'd be in a very different Milwaukee today if not for this incident. And you really have to hand it to someone like Josie Carter, who, I mean, was living in a time of great marginalization.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me and share the story of the night brawl. I could listen to hours more of all the little intricacies of this story. But thank you for sharing it with us, and thank you for all of your work.
Okay, thanks so much.
Michael Takash is a historian and vice president of communications for Milwaukee Pride. Pride Fest starts today at the Henry Meyer Festival grounds, and you can find out more at WUWM.com. Another thing that's kicking off today is Sculpture Milwaukee's 3 years of public art along Wisconsin Avenue. We'll chat with one of the artists whose work is wrapping the Chase Building atrium when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Art is sprouting along Wisconsin Avenue. From John Baldessari's penguin statue in Northwestern Mutual's garden to Beverly Pepper's steel curves at the western edge of the project, this third year of Sculpture Milwaukee has brought more whimsy, beauty, and thought-provoking work to the city. The WUWM studios are directly above one of the largest installations. Commissioned by Sculpture Milwaukee, Chicago artist Carlos Rolon has taken the glass atrium of the Chase Building and enveloped it in translucent panels of bright flowers. It turns the space into something Carlos calls a jewel box. He and Mary Lou Canode, who is the Director of Exhibitions and Programs of Sculpture Milwaukee, joined me in the studio just as the installation was beginning to tell us more, starting with how they first knew of each other.
I had worked with Carlos many years ago when I was up at UWM at Innova, and I had followed his work. We'd been in contact. I'd seen shows that you had done elsewhere. And, you know, as time went on, it's always about finding the right opportunity to work with somebody, and I just thought this would be a really excellent time for us to partner on doing a project. We sort of started off thinking, well, maybe we could do this, and the way we ended up with the decorating of the birdcage was through process. We really talked about what's possible, what would have the biggest impact, too, and how can we do something that's the most crazy fun, because in fact that's what people want to see from contemporary art. There are all kinds of ways you can make art that are meaningful and engaging, but with public art, scale is really critical, and sometimes really small is good, but really big is good too. So I feel like it was just the right place. And then, of course, you know, Becky and Muggs and the Farbman Group have been incredible partners, and they've been very supportive. Yeah, yeah.
So. I was going to say, did you have trouble with them at all, with the Chase folks, to even get it up?
No, they were pretty enthusiastic. And what I'm really happy about for Sculpture Milwaukee is, you know, I think with the success of this piece, we'll have more of the people along Wisconsin Avenue willing to take a chance on something that is not traditional for them, but really pretty straightforward in our world. The art world does, you see all kinds of crazy things that are meaningful because artists use the tools that are available to them today. You know, I think a lot of people think sculpture is still man on horse or mermaid in fountain, and it's everything that's
or some
on,
kind of weird angular thing that you can't quite decide what it is.
Geometric abstraction is a historically bound aesthetic generally. But, you know, to describe the continuum of life's experience through the art that reflects that, I think that's the really exciting part.
And it's very democratic as well. I mean, it's one of those things that the public can experience firsthand. And it's one of those things that no matter what background you're from, what culture you're from, it's one of those things that you want to create a visceral experience for someone. And so when they walk upon it or they see it, and what's to, you know, take a nod from what Mary Lou was saying, I mean, I've been receiving messages via social media that people who live in Milwaukee and just on the outskirts of Milwaukee, they're going to be traveling to come see the installation. And, you know, there was an architect who actually sent me a message yesterday on Facebook just saying, I work right across the street and I never even thought of producing something like this. And so the hope is that, you know, this will continue on and, you know, it'll, the story can continue after this is, you know, done and over with.
So did you have the idea for what's going in down there ahead of time, or was it once you knew you had that space?
No, I think, you know, one of the things that I've been talking about for the past few days is that, you know, when you look at the piece and you look at the installation, the immediate reaction is this fits so well. And it works so well because we've been working so hard behind the scenes. So, you know, whenever you see something happen, you know, especially in the art world and especially with what Mary Lou's doing, it's very hard to take a work of art, make sure that you place it, you know, at the right moment in the right environment. So if it looks organic, that means that she has gone through several steps with the artist to make sure that it works the right way. When we first came to the site visit, we were talking about doing something in the Skyway, and we went across the street. We looked at different vantage points. You know, I just had this, you know, sometimes I can be a horse with blinders on, and I kept thinking, you know, Mary Lou, I really want to do a large sculpture. I want to do something by the water, and, you know, maybe we can do something that can reflect off the water and take advantage of, you know, different vantage points. And then all of a sudden, light bulb moment came on, and we both just looked across the ways from across the street and just saw the birdcage, which I call the jewel box. But I just looked at it, and I'm a huge fan of architecture. You know, I'm from Chicago. I collect, you know, mid-century furniture. I'm just a huge fan of Mies van der Rohe, and it had that effect. And it just, again, as soon as I saw the building and as soon as we saw it, it was like, wouldn't it be incredible to place something on that building that could take advantage of the real estate around, but in a very positive manner.
And it's such an important building architecturally.
I love it. And
yeah.
I did my history on it. And in fact, I think that the day that we went to go, when we just started talking about it, I immediately started doing research and, you know, found, you know, the architects and when it was built, I think it was 61. And, you know, so beyond just creating the imagery for it, I've done my research on the history of the building, which is really important.
Did you want to complement what you saw, or were you trying to play against it?
It's one of those things where I ended up going off on my own and taking several images from across the street, you know, kitty corner, and then I went on Google Earth and I began doing research via Google Earth, taking 360 images from the internet to really see how I can, you know, take advantage of the space and complement the architecture. So it, in my opinion, it should look completely natural to the real estate and to the architecture, and it should look completely natural and organic to the public. So instead of placing, let's just say, for the sake of saying it, placing a large banner or sticker on something, I wanted to make sure that I worked within the structure of the building, but at the same time, I needed to keep true to my studio practice. So what you're seeing, what the public sees, and what many people may not know is that what they're looking at is an actual painting. What you're seeing are not computer-generated or stock images that I've put together. What you're seeing is actually one of my paintings that I produced in the studio.
And so when we were talking before we came in the studio and you said, you know, you opened the package and you got your Star Wars figure, that's because what's happened, you sent it out to get blown up. Right? To get into that, into the material that you're actually attaching to the building.
Correct. The feeling that we, so Marilyn and I have been working with the fabricators over the course of several months. She and I have been working on this for the past year, just discussing and going back and forth. So to get down to the wire, you know, when you're working on a project, there's a sense of confidence, and then there's a sense of, there's a culpability of just, okay, this is really happening. And then there's a sense of
okay, we really have to make sure that this is done correctly. So, you know, you go through the different stages. And even though I was getting large sections of test panels that were sent to me, so what you see are maybe it's like the second or third iteration. So once I got the files, I felt that the pixelation needed to be tweaked a little bit. So I took it and I handed it off to another person that I work with to correct the pixelation. Then we worked with the fabricator and we're, you know, how many passes so we can get the right amount of light that comes through that you can see outside. There really is a lot of work that goes into it. And again, being an artist in my studio and then taking myself out of the comfort zone and, you know, and thanks to Mary Lou, she's taking me out of my comfort zone because I'm able to have one of my paintings realized, you know, four stories high. But with that comes, you know, I'm very meticulous and I'm very genuine when it comes to my work. And so I needed to make sure that whatever I was going to see on the facade was exactly what I would see in my studio. So you have all these things running through your head and you start, you know, questioning certain things. And then you start sending messages back and forth, you know, at 10 o'clock at night to the fabricator and making sure that things are on schedule and it's exactly how you want it. And then at some point, you know, I'm a big Eckhart Tolle fan. So, you know, I let the universe work. At some point, you have to allow things to let be and you have to let go and you have to allow things to work as they should. So I just basically put it out. And I have to tell you that as soon as I drove up yesterday, I couldn't be happier. I literally was, it was like a kid at Christmas.
And you feel the same way?
Oh, I'm just thrilled. And because I've been looking at this little thumbnail, you know, like 2-inch square thing for such a long time, I was a little concerned that wouldn't meet my imagination. It far exceeds my imagination. And often when I'm writing about Sculpture Milwaukee or artwork that I haven't seen in real life before, you know, you have a sort of a narrative around it. And yesterday I had this, I sort of flashed on the idea that, you know, nature will overtake humanity and its culture. So, you know, we found a lot of, you know, ancient cultures in deserts. But when you think about Southeast Asia, for example, the way that they can map, you know, Latin America is by, you know, from the sky X-raying things because nature just grows back over all these monuments that we grow to ourselves, that we make to ourselves. And I think you're speaking yesterday, or was it today, Carlos, about sort of the hybridization of the plants that were brought by the Spanish to Latin America and to the Caribbean is written in your pieces, too. So it seems like this beautiful celebration of nature and summer. And, you know, there's so many layers to your work. It's not just how beautiful flowers are from Hawaii or you know, Puerto Rico. It's really about how humans have always controlled nature and how nature sort of fights back against us sometimes.
I was going to say, we try to control nature. Yeah. And sometimes we succeed very well, but give it time and it will take over.
She'll always win.
Yeah.
Mother Nature will always win.
Always
wins.
Yeah. And it's also touching about migration and talking about, you know, I mean, a lot of the flora that you see is man-made, you know, some of it is a hybrid, which is man-made, but, and it's because of change and migration and colonization. And it's not just about one culture. I mean, this has been happening, you know, since, you know, I mean,
since humans,
humans were, I mean, a lot of it is about, you know, when the Spanish were looking for gold in the Caribbean and in the Gulf of Mexico and what the flora may have looked like before they were looking for gold and they, before they tore apart the indigenous lands. But at the same time, they brought over, slaves from, you know, that were Jewish, North African. And so they also brought culture and they also brought, you know, music, they brought food, and they also brought different species of plants, which again talks about the idea of migration and creating something new again.
Creating something new and also, you know, the fear of the new thing taking over the old thing of displacing it.
Correct.
Of somehow losing native things to the interlopers. But, you know, when you think it, you kind of pull back the lens a little bit and you think about it, I mean, that is sort of, that's how the world works.
It,
you know, the
it does.
Birds are dropping seeds and things are happening and it may be happening. I mean, humans, I think, are a bigger agent of change probably than just about anything else. But, you know, we've been all changing the land and figuring it out and negotiating with each other for eons.
It's okay to have change, you know, as long as it's done respectfully and it's done the right way. And, you know, but you also have to accept change, you know. So maybe there's something that you didn't see beforehand, and there's something that's new, and, you know, you have to accept it and work with it. So, you know, I mean, you look at gentrification in Chicago, and, you know, I grew up on the southwest side of Chicago, which is, you know, when I was growing up, my family moved in the southwest side, and we're one of two Puerto Rican families, and most of it was, you know, I grew up around Eastern European, mostly Polish. So I'd have klaczki's on Sundays, and, you know, there's Polish mass, but, you know, I actually absolutely loved it. I embraced it, and I loved, you know, and I still love the Polish culture. And that's the honest to God truth. It actually allowed me to create an installation and a project at the National Museum in Warsaw because of that upbringing. But at the same time, you know, people in the neighborhood, there was this identity crisis for me. So when I didn't see a lot of myself in the neighborhood, when I went to museums, I didn't see a reflection of me being Latino or Puerto Rican at the Art Institute. I didn't see a lot of that, and I still don't see it. I still don't see much of it today within the certain institutions. So, you know, it's part of my job is to actually tell this story. But I feel, and again, in a very democratic way, because what I'm happy about with the work is that it crosses over into pop culture, because I feel, again, if you're Black, white, purple, Jewish, it doesn't matter what background you come from. I think when you know about the work and you understand the story and about the change, and that I'm discussing change, but in about class, race, beauty, I think everyone can really understand that.
So Mary Lou, are you hoping to keep it? Or is it too early to ask that question?
Well, you know, it's interesting. That would really be up to the building owners, of course. And, you know, that's one of the great joys about the public art that we do, is because it's temporary, it allows people to really sort of test their own perceptions about what they like and what they don't like. And, you know, I think the thing is, no matter what, people are going to learn a lot about sculpture this year. And I think we're really challenging people to think about, you know, again, what in their own world is, you know, cultural or created by a creative person. Everything is. So can we really make that message clear to people?
And also, what's important to me personally is that if I can be a voice for the Latinx community, and if also, especially what just happened in Puerto Rico with the hurricane and the devastation that happened, you know, if I can bring a voice, you know, to the island of Puerto Rico, and being an artist from Chicago of Puerto Rican descent, and if I can bring a message and actually raise awareness indirectly, you know, I couldn't be happier about that.
Carlos Rolon is a Chicago-based artist whose work, Gild the Lily, has transformed the Chase Tower atrium. Mary Lou Canode is the director of exhibitions and programs for Sculpture Milwaukee. You can find out more about Carlos's work and about all of the other sculptures on view along Wisconsin Avenue at WUWM.com. Today is the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. Essayist Art Sear has some thoughts about it when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Today marks the 75th anniversary in a watershed moment from a watershed global conflict. It's a day that Lake Effect essayist Art Sear thinks we should all look at as we consider our own perilous times.
From ancient times, military professionals rightly regard amphibious invasions as especially challenging. We recognize and honor the 75th anniversary of the greatest such operation, the Allies' invasion of France in World War II, on June 6, 1944, D-Day. The Normandy invasion combined thorough planning, mobilizing vast materiel, and great imagination. When the vast operation underway was announced, a U.S. newspaper highlighted a front-page drawing of invading soldiers cascading into Europe as a terrified Hitler fled. A year of extremely brutal, almost continuous combat lay ahead, but the end of Nazi Germany was in sight once the beaches were secured. The leadership of Supreme Allied Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower was crucial. Ike demonstrated great executive ability in supervising the enormous logistics and brilliant interpersonal skill that welded and held together the most diverse military alliance in history. Remarkably, he was able to establish overall unity of command. This eluded even the American military alone in the Pacific, where Army General Douglas MacArthur pursued one strategic vision, while U.S. Navy admirals implemented a different approach. Extensive bombing of transport routes and supply depots in France was viewed by Eisenhower as crucial preparation. Such action would bring an estimated minimum of 60,000 civilian casualties, and perhaps far more. For various reasons, many American and British air commanders resisted, arguing for a more limited effort. Eisenhower was adamant about the absolute need for extensive bombing, arguing that less would put the risky invasion in even graver danger. Free French General Charles de Gaulle agreed and gave unequivocal support. Ike had managed to establish an effective working relationship with the insecure, temperamental French leader. Simultaneously, the American commander never lost awareness of the terrible human costs of war, borne primarily by the enlisted ranks. He constantly stressed the fundamentally important role of the combat soldier and regularly went to see troops in the field. This dimension is captured especially by classic photographs of his visit with young American paratroopers preparing to depart to initiate D-Day. Finally, Eisenhower had brilliant imagination. During heavy fighting for Sicily in 1943, General George S. Patton, Jr. slapped two U.S. soldiers suffering extreme combat stress. Intense controversy resulted. Nazi leaders dismissed the entire matter as propaganda. The German military executed thousands of their own men as regular routine. Ike moved Patton to England to reflect in isolation. Meanwhile, a fictitious army emerged around him. Actors were assigned roles, bogus information generated, phony buildings and vehicles constructed. On D-Day and immediately thereafter, crucial German units remained in reserve, partly because Patton's fictitious forces had not yet moved. Both Eisenhower and Patton were gifted leaders, naturally complementary. The first direct combat between American and German forces occurred in early 1943 at Kasserine Pass in Tunisia. General Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps devastated inexperienced, often terrified U.S. troops and inept commanders. Approximately 2,000 American men were lost, the vast majority captured. Many simply surrendered when faced by the Germans. The already controversial Patton was then appointed their commander. Shortly thereafter, these U.S. troops defeated the Africa Corps at El Guitar. Rommel observed he never saw soldiers more poorly prepared for a real battle or more able to improve quickly than these Americans. Eisenhower was a supremely gifted leader of Americans, and many others as well. When he died, President Richard M. Nixon's eulogy compared him to George Washington, first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen.
Essayist Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He is also a regular contributor to Lake Effect. Muslims worldwide are celebrating Eid al-Fitr, the three-day festival marking the end of the Islamic holy fasting month of Ramadan. WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar went to the Wisconsin Center in downtown Milwaukee on Tuesday as thousands gathered for a communal prayer, and she brings us this audio postcard.
It's a sunny day, and the Wisconsin Center is filled with brightly dressed women and elegantly dressed men. It's a diverse crowd of Wisconsin Muslims, different languages, nationalities, and different styles of dress.
So this is basically the traditional Pakistani dress. It's called the shalwar kameez. The styles change over the years. The basic elements stay the same. It's looser pants and a longer shirt that comes with like a very like a fancy scarf.
The woman wearing the outfit is Selma Akhtar, and standing close by her is her sister Samavia Akhtar. I ask her, What does Eid al-Fitr mean?
So basically, at the end of Ramadan, after the last day, we have this day where we all get together as a community, and we basically celebrate like the fasting that we did, and it represents like all the self-control that we had for the whole month, and how our like all the religious members come together, and it's a very special time for our community in general. Like everyone's seeing each other after the whole month, it's really special.
Faraj Jabir has been celebrating Eid al-Fitr in Milwaukee for many years after moving from his home country in Palestine, which he refers to in Arabic as Palestine.
It's great in Palestine, but I love it more here because there's diversity of people from Pakistan, from Yemen, from all over. And we all, what makes this day special here is that we are one Muslim community, one ummah, and I pray that we will be thinking that way.
On a day like Eid, what is it that you say in Arabic?
We say, تقبل الله طاعتكم وكل عام وأنتم بخير, which means in English, Allah accept your prayers and your sacrifice and everything you have done throughout the month. We hope every year you're still healthy, you and your family and the whole world.
After communal Eid prayer, people gather in each other's homes and eat, something that three young girls were particularly excited about.
My name is Aissatou Diallo. I am from here, but my parents are born in Africa.
I'm her sister. I'm Adama, and both of our parents are from Senegal and Guinea.
My favorite part about today is that the praying part, and then when we're done praying, we have a party to celebrate the end. That's mine too.
The greater Milwaukee area has an estimated Muslim population of 15 to 20,000. More than 5,000 turned out to participate in the communal prayer downtown to celebrate Eid al-Fitr.
Thank you.
For Lake Effect, I'm Angelina Mosier Salazar.
People marking Eid al-Fitr, the three-day festival that concludes the fasting month of Ramadan, this week at the Wisconsin Center in Milwaukee. Our segment was produced by WUWM's Angelina Mosier Salazar. We'll take one last break, and then our innovation reporter takes a closer look at energy storage and what some homeowners are doing now. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North. Governor Tony Evers caused a bit of a stir this year when he said Wisconsin should have a goal of generating carbon-free electricity by the year 2050. That would mean no coal-fired power plants in the state and several other changes. Energy experts say one of those changes would likely involve more use of devices to temporarily store electricity from cleaner sources like solar and wind power. WUWM's innovation reporter Chuck Kornbach takes a closer look at energy storage, including what some homeowners are doing right now.
Governor Evers told news reporters on March 1st that it's important the state have goals, including going to carbon-free electricity within 30 years.
We set other goals as it relates to minimum wage and other areas that we can get to in over a period of time. So we feel it's important to set goals, and that's one of them.
Republicans in the state legislature have since removed the carbon-free language from the Democrats' state budget proposal, arguing it's a policy item. But some Wisconsin utilities have promised to reduce their carbon emissions, and other states are aiming to eventually go carbon-free. Devices like energy storage units are expected to be of help. West Bend resident Peter Gibault already has one in his basement. Gibault takes the cover off of one of two plastic boxes on his basement floor. Inside each container, known as a battery bank, are 8 flooded lead-acid batteries, about the size you might find in a car. Other equipment called inverters, charge controllers, and disconnects are nearby. Gibault says the unit takes in and stores electricity generated by 23 solar panels on the roof of his house.
During the day, the solar panels charge up the batteries, and then during the night, when there's no sun, everything is coming off the batteries.
Gibault says he's had the battery storage system for about 3 years. He says it provides his household more energy independence and far lower utility bills, though the home is still connected to the electrical grid as a backup. Gibault also believes he's helping reduce pollution from coal or natural gas-fired power plants and having fun along the way.
And it's also my midlife crisis. So this whole system was a lot cheaper than a Porsche.
Especially, Gibault says, with federal tax credits and financial help from the state's Focus on Energy Renewable Energy Program. Installers of energy storage systems say improved technology is making storage more attractive. In the warehouse of Arch Electric in Plymouth, owner Ed Zinthafer slices open a cardboard box containing a battery unit about the size of a large DVD player.
This is a lithium cell, and we can stack as many as six of these into one unit, getting up to about 19.6 kilowatt hours of storage.
Kilowatt hours, or kWh, is a measure of power consumption. 19.6 kWh is likely enough storage to power an average home for at least a day. Zinthafer says the growth in lithium storage batteries is changing the game for homeowners.
Because we can put more storage in a residence now than we could a couple of years ago, because we can pack more kWh into a lithium battery than we can in a flooded lead acid.
Zinthafer cautions that one lithium battery unit can cost a few $1,000s and that energy storage isn't yet right for every home. But he says it's getting more affordable.
Refinement cost reductions. In the last year, we've seen about a 10% decrease in the cost of our lithium-based batteries. And if that trend continues, it's only a matter of time before every consumer has the good opportunity to make that financial decision.
Some hospitals and other institutions are also using battery storage. And lately, even some Wisconsin electric utilities and transmission firms are considering much larger storage systems that could set aside power for whole communities. MWRC, the Midwest Energy Research Consortium, recently held a Milwaukee forum on utility-scale energy storage. UW-Madison Professor of Energy Finance Tim Bay took part. He says some of the utility interest is realizing some consumers want more control over their home's energy supply through devices like programmable smartphone apps.
The Gen Xers, the millennials, all want that type of ability. And so we're starting to see these market forces kind of come into sync.
But part of utility-scale energy storage may need state regulation. And Public Service Commission Chairperson Becky Vock says one of her goals will be to make sure people who can afford storage units don't push up electricity costs for those who can't.
I always think about it as sort of a water balloon. If you're pushing on it one end, it's got to go someplace else.
Vock says it's possible the PSC will open what's called a generic docket or investigation to ask more questions about what energy storage would mean for everyone. Chuck Quernbach, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Chuck Quernbach is WUWM's innovation reporter. You can hear more of his stories at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. It has been such a pleasure having you with us today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.